Tonight on Arena, the RTE Concert Orchestra finally get to play together again after a long silence, and Helen Cullen on her second novel, The Truth Must Dazzle Gradually. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The summer of 2020 has certainly been like no other for musicians and the arts community. There has been a loss of connection with audiences. But on Saturday the 29th of August, Shine, an hour of music and words filmed at the Ivy Gardens, the National Concert Hall and here in RTE over a few days, will be broadcast on RTE One television with subsequent broadcasts here on Radio One and indeed an extended item on the RTE player. The National Concert Hall plays hosts to Dermot Kennedy and Denise Chyla with the RTE Concert Orchestra, a first for both orchestra and venue since the pandemic silenced orchestra performances a few months back now. Joining me on the line is violinist Brona Cahill of the orchestra and clarinetist Michael Seaver is with me here in the studio, and I could almost hear the audible sigh of relief from you, Michael, in studio, and nearly Brona on the phone as well when we got that clarification today. It was very confusing for a period of time as to whether you'd be able to perform at all.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it was only this afternoon I just saw on Twitter, National Campaign of the Arts had kind of got final clarification. But yeah, it makes a big difference. I mean, we're now just getting back to the full orchestra being in the one venue. So the next step for us, you know, is to get a live audience. I mean, that's what all the artists want. Mm. Art is about making a community, if it's just for a couple of hours in the concert hall, and that's really what we miss most. We've had a good few months of recordings and Zoom recordings as well.
Yeah, I hear you sighing as you say that. I think a lot of people sigh when they hear it. You know, and I know this was an attempt to obviously stay in touch with audiences, and it's vitally important that was done. But the desire to see and hear live performance, I finally got to see a piece of live theatre with Stanley Townsend in Soul of Bones in Kilkenny over the weekend. It was a great experience just to be in a theatre, you know, with something happening. Brona, Mick's talking there about this whole idea of creating a community. Nowhere more is there a community than in an orchestra. I mean, you can't exist without each other. It must have been very odd over the period of, you know, when you couldn't actually be in the same room together. It must have been a very odd experience as a player.
Yes, I mean, most of the recordings were done in my practice room, which is generally a very serious place, Sean, you know, for working. And to transfer that into sort of trying to get a performance feel, you know, because it's still, you want to feel somehow that energy when you're still recording. So it was really tricky to get the balance, but the team were great because they'd always come up with different ideas to keep us motivated and excited about it, but it was still very hard. I mean, when I actually put on my high heels and my black ear, just to feel like I was doing something, you know.
I suppose
we met each other on the stage, you know, obviously.
But, I mean, for the purposes of these recordings, there still must have been, it must have been slightly different from the usual situation where, you know, you're very close to the person sitting, if you're in first violins, the other person sitting beside you is only a couple of feet away from you. Did that have to be adjusted?
When we went into the concert hall, it was very much so. They were very, you know, we all had our temperature checked going in. They were all very strict and we wore masks. Tricky if you're wearing glasses and trying to read the music. And then, you know, being 2 metres apart just felt like, you know, 50 feet, really, in terms of the difference of the feeling and the sensation of the energy. I mean, we all work off each other's energy. It's inexplicable. It's hard to describe because once we're going and playing on the stage, it's contagious.
Yeah, you're just dropping. You're dropping in and out slightly there, but I'll come to Mick on this. Picking up on what Brona is saying there, the energy that you pick up off each other, Mick. I suppose I've often heard it said: if you want to know what dynamic you should be playing at, well, how loud or how soft you should be playing. If you can't hear the person beside you, you're playing too loudly.
Well, exactly.
But if you're distanced from that person, it becomes something totally different.
Yeah, it kind of changes the whole balance, and you need to make those adjustments. I mean, during the lockdown, I was, you know, talking to neighbours and kind of explained to them that it's a bit like a football team, that, you know, we feed off the group dynamic all the time. Mm. And if we're off, of course, we do our individual practice, but it's not the same as playing no more than a player would go into the gym and do their individual fitness but coming together as a team is completely different.
Different experience.
So, I mean, you're losing that touch. But then, you know, so you get the wonderful Liverpool team to play in a pitch that's four times the size, and you wonder why their slick passing game isn't there. It's exactly the same with an orchestra. You know, you need that. There's a good reason that we sit so close together, and that's just to get that homogenous sound, which is really the thing that you miss most when you're sitting at home, in between your neighbour mowing the grass to eventually find a quiet moment to record your little bit of it's something that would be. And the sound people here did a great job in getting everything together, because you record on one device and somebody has a different device and the sound is completely different. So all that balancing had to be done to stick it all together.
And I don't even want to think about what the tuning situations were.
Yeah, we would have a note in the beginning. But again, tuning is a variable thing. You're all the time adjusting to the people
sound around
you.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the recordings that you did manage to do for this Shine event. Now, I think you were particularly excited around the Dermot Kennedy aspect of things. Brona, am I right?
Yes, I am a huge fan. I was a bit starstruck. I think he's amazing. So it was fabulous to get to play with him. He's such a powerful voice, and it was great. It really was amazing, and he filled us confidence. Even though we were all, I think it's going to be a fabulous recording. It's really going to look fab as well.
So again, performing in the concert hall in that situation to an empty hall, does that matter? Or you know, when you're setting up the recordings, how big a problem is that for you as a performer?
They had the mics above us, you know. They had all the sound engineers were totally on it. I think it's going to sound amazing. But from our point of view, we had click track for some of it, and the conductor was there. So it was just, it's much more visual now. You really have to watch the beat.
Yeah.
Because the sound is just so spread out. It's just so different. It's going to be a whole new learning curve for us of how to do this.
Yes, because I know certain conductors, and they'll remain nameless, who could give you a look if you weren't looking at them, and you would feel them looking at you to get your eyes up off the page and
well,
up at him or her. But Denise Chyla then was one of the other performers that was involved in all of this, Mick, and we were talking a little bit about it. I was talking about her before we came to air. I mean, she really has rocketed onto the scene at a very difficult time, it has to be said, for any new performer. What struck you about her when you were recording?
Well, the first thing was that my kids have been going around saying it's not Chile, it's not Chilala. They've been singing that for the past month and a half. And then to finally to meet her and perform with her, it was absolutely great. And she was very taken with performing with an orchestra. She really enjoyed it.
And this was her first time actually with an orchestra as well. How did she handle that? Because it's a big deal.
Yeah, it is. But she's the business.
She's a big deal.
Yeah.
The piece then that she performed, The Holy Grail, what are your memories of this in the recording period?
Well, I hadn't heard it before. The other one we recorded was Chaila.
I'm not Chile, I'm not.
Exactly. And it's different, the Chaila. So it's a different kind of sound. So it really intrigued me as to, you know, what's going to develop from her in the next while.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to this song then, called The Holy Grail, Denise Chyla, performing alongside the RTE Concert Orchestra. Denise Chyla there and The Holy Grail, and this is part of Shine, a programme with the RTE Concert Orchestra that's going to be broadcast on RTE television this coming Sunday, and indeed subsequently, Saturday the 29th of August rather, and subsequently on Radio 1 and on the RTE player. Michael Seaver, clarinetist with the RTE Concert Orchestra, with me in studio, and Brona Cahill is joining us on the phone. I was asking Mick as we were listening to that, I was talking to him about the nature of the performance that Denise Chyla gives there. That's not bad for a first time with an orchestra, Brona, because it's quite a beast to control. And if you hear some of the delicacies that she has in that hip hop, those hip hop sections, I know Gavin Maloney obviously was keeping the whole thing together, Gavin conducting, as Mick told me, but she has a phenomenal facility.
She has, and actually she was so sweet because she was really emotional after it, you know, after her first performance there. She was so taken aback and so thankful and so lovely, turned round to us all and thanked us and said it was just amazing for her, and then goes back and completely goes into character and nails it a second time.
Yeah.
You know, she really took on the personality and it was a great performance.
Yeah, I've only seen her perform in terms of the National Gallery, the other voices thing that went out online. I've never seen her perform live. I can't wait to see her perform live because, I mean, she has this facility on screen and certainly even speaking to her on air, she's a real power of nature. But speaking of emotions, Brona, what was that first morning like when the orchestra got back together as a group? You know, people that you're used to seeing, certainly most weeks, I would have thought, if not a few days every week.
Oh, yes, yes.
What was the feeling when you all arrived into the room and even sat down to tune? Must have been a phenomenal moment.
Yes, asking for the aim, just that familiar sound was just like Fudger home. You know, it was all just like meeting up with the family again. It's so strange. Like, it's a strange bond we have, you know, and we all just get on with it as well at the same time. We're just very much doing our thing with our instruments as well. But we were very emotional. Everybody was.
Yeah.
And curious as well of how it was all going to go. A little bit nervous as well. It was really lovely.
Brona mentioned about having to wear the mask, which she can do as a violin player. Clearly, you can't wear a mask as a clarinet player.
No,
but there must be considerations around wind instruments, and if I can be delicate about this, about the saliva that might be emanating from that instrument and indeed from all the brass instruments.
Indeed.
How
mostly
do we deal
condensation.
With that?
There is a thing called a spit valve, which is not a nice idea. But basically, all the condensation that collects within a brass instrument can be released. And with a clarinet or a flute or an oboe, there would be some droplets of condensation that would hit the ground. They would just evaporate within, you know, a couple of minutes. But obviously now, stuff like that, we need to be, you know, mindful of droplets. So we all were issued with little Tupperware canisters to dispose of our condensation. Now, for the brass players, they can put their little hole over and release it. But for clarinets, we just had to just strategically aim so that if any small drops did come out, we went into that. But you know what? It's a small price to pay for the joy of actually coming together as a group.
Coming together and play. And I guess a moment when you and all the other string players, Brona, must have wanted to phone your parents up and thank them immediately that they didn't choose you or didn't send you in the direction of playing a wind instrument.
It was funny because it was funny because I was watching the winds and they didn't have the masks on. It was fine, they're all behind screens, you know, and we had the masks on, but it was actually quite difficult because it was so hot. And you know, when you're getting into it, you're getting a bit breathy yourself, you know, when you're getting into the music.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit claustrophobic at times. My glasses kept slipping down my nose and steering up. So it was interesting. It's interesting. So it's quite difficult actually playing with the mask, but we'll have to get used to it.
Yeah.
You know, we played yesterday in the RDS, and it was the full orchestra back together, and it was very airy and great. It was really, that was amazing. That was a full orchestra back together.
Yeah, because I know I was asking Mick again while we were listening to Denise Child about when was the orchestra, when did you start getting back together? And I remember the last day of the School Hub, that programme that came up out of nowhere onto RTE1 television and became such a big hit. The orchestra were involved in the final day of that beautifully in the grounds. It was Skull Lorcan on it was shot, wasn't it?
Lorcan,
so
yeah.
What did you do there, Mick?
Well, we had to record everything beforehand, again, in our own living rooms or bedrooms, and that was put together. But they thought visually it'd be great if the orchestra was there. And again, just half of the orchestra, that was all they could fit. So we just sat in the schoolyard, and it was all very carefully managed. We had a room to wait. We were all socially distanced at that stage. And then we just mimed to what we had recorded already for it. And of course, the big thrill came at the end when they launched the drone to take those fabulous aerial shots of us. So it was, but I mean, it was just a great experience. Just that was our very first time coming back together as a group. Even though we weren't technically playing together, we did play.
Yeah. I'd done the playing previous.
Yeah.
What then are your hopes? I know obviously Shine is going out, as I said, television Saturday the 29th at 8:15 p.m, Radio 1 on Sunday afternoon, 4 p.m. And then there's Shine On, which is a bit of an extended, a few extended numbers involved in that, maybe?
Yeah, they're kind of extra numbers that will be going on to the RT player.
Right.
And then I think John Creedon is putting together a programme on RT Radio 1 on Sunday the
30th. Sunday afternoon, the 4 p.m. Lovely thing to listen to on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah. What are your hopes then for the autumn season and for the orchestra from this point on?
Well, we do have recording projects lined up for September. But I have to say, we went into the RDS yesterday and we were in one of the big industry halls. And looking around, there is space for people to come in, and I think the day that we get even 50 people just to socially distance, get in and to play for people and to, as I said earlier, create that community again, that would be a big thrill.
Kind of getting spine is tingling at even at the thought of hearing an orchestra playing in a live space. And for you, Brian, is it something similar?
Yes, when you speak of emotion, actually the last concert we did was in the Board Gash for the Leonard Cohen tribute.
Wow.
And the second night of that, I started getting emotional because it was around the time of when it was everything was hotting up about COVID and would there be a lockdown, and it was that sensation. I actually really felt it would be my last time on stage for a long, long time. I just felt it. And I did get very emotional at the thought of not being able to do this for, and you know, you didn't know how long it was going to be, but we didn't think it would be this long. And hopefully with this new thing, if we could, the hall is big enough to hold, it would be amazing to just get back to doing concerts. It really would. Even, you know, if there's something outdoor can be done in September, or, you know, I think we have to get back to music. There has to be live music back. It's important. Really is.
It certainly is. And I will be at the top of the queue if there's going to be a performance somewhere to get to see and hear you guys. But listen, thanks very much.
We'll miss the concert night as well.
Yeah, the big items won't be happening there. Yeah, we can't have that big event, of course. But anyway, listen, great to speak with you both this evening, and continued success, and hope that this is the first of many outings for the RT Concert Orchestra in the autumn of 2020. Michael Seaver, clarinetist, Brona Cahill, violinist, speaking to me there. Shine will air, as you heard there, on RT1 Saturday the 29th of August at 8:15 p.m. There's lots of others, not just the RT Concert Orchestra and Denise Child and Dermot Kennedy. Their villagers are there, Pillow Queens, Loa, Book of Brass and Niamh Farrell, Cormac Begley, Celine Byrne and Emer Barry, Monham, Murray McGarley, John Boyne, and believe it or not, more. However, they've managed to get all of that into one programme. You'll subsequently get it on RT1, the radio, 4 p.m. Sunday, the RT player after that. This week sees the publication of a new novel from Donal Ryan. Strange Flowers follows the fortune of the Gladney family, forever marked by the sudden disappearance of their 20-year-old daughter, Moll, one morning in 1973. And by her return 5 years later. Here is Donal Ryan, reading an extract for us.
Paddy Gladney felt every day of his 61 years, and he felt more than that. He felt ancient and ruined and spiritless and dead, as though there was no meaning to him or his life, as though he was a thin, fleshy bag of old bones and gristle and muscles that worked from their own memory of working, and not from any agency of his. That it mattered not one bit to the world or to any being in it if he lived or died. That there were dozens, hundreds, thousands, millions of creatures that could pedal a bicycle and hand envelopes to people or push them through letterboxes and walk the land morning and evening and count and fodder dry stock and mend a fence here and there. And what use was he if not as a father? And how could he call himself a father and his only begotten child gone from him, away from him, and not a sign of her anywhere? Lost to him, lost, lost, lost. Time is relentless, though, and heartless, and it insists on its own propagation, its own terrible replication of itself, moment after moment after moment. And just as relentless are the things that fill it, the bits and pieces that all put together add up to existence, to a life, all the big things that take up the greater part of the mind, and all the small things that sit waiting at the back of the mind. Things that can't be ignored or left undone. Letters and parcels and lambs and calves and fences and posts and chickens and hedgerows and mass and confession and missing daughters and angry little sons and heirs of landed people and what have you. And cold, shadowed corners of the graveyard in Yohalara and the mulch-rich soil there, blackening and thickening with the years and fallen leaves, biding its time, waiting to be turned, to be opened, to receive. In the years that followed their dear Moll's departure on the Nina bus and the Dublin train, Peddy and Kit Gladney lived a solemn half-life of work and prayers and weakening hope, and the earth spun and the moon phased and the rain fell and the sun shone and their hearts grew heavier and heavier with grief. And a full 5 years went past and more, and one Friday in spring, when there was a cool breeze blowing uphill from the lake and the sun was high and white in the sky, and Peddy Gladney was cleaning his boots on the scraper by the half door, he heard the clang of the gate opening at the top of the lane. And he turned and looked, and he saw his daughter there across the yard, closing the gate behind her, like a good girl, the way she'd always been told to. And he closed his eyes, and he opened them again on the greening hedgerow along the edge of the lane, and the briars and the bursting buds all along it, and the new lambs small and white in the haggard, and the strutting cockerel and the angry clucking hens, and the mucky pat that ran from the half door where he stood to the gate at the top of the lane where his daughter stood, looking back at him, smiling shyly at him like a child.
The inimitable voice there of Donal Ryan reading from Strange Flowers. That's his new novel, just published by Doubleday. And Sophie Gorman will review Strange Flowers for us here on Arena in a fortnight's time, in fact, on Wednesday, September the 2nd. London-based Irish writer Helen Cullen has just published her second novel. The Truth Will Dazzle Gradually comes hot on the heels of her debut, The Lost Letters of William Wolfe, which saw Helen shortlisted for Newcomer of the Year at the Irish Book Awards. This new book was due to be published in May, but as I've been saying about so many things recently, COVID intervened. Fans have had to wait until now to sink their teeth into The Truth Will Dazzle Gradually. Among those fans is Graham Norton, who's been busy tweeting praise for the new book. And I'm delighted to join, or to have Helen Cullen join me now on the phone. Great to get an endorsement from Graham Norton, I would have thought, Helen.
Oh, hello, Sean. Thanks so much for having me on this evening to talk to you. It's a joy. Yes, I have to say it was a kind of a thrilling moment when I received the notification that Graham had been tweeting about the book. But to be honest, it's amazing when anybody tells you that they've connected with the book and that they love it. So it is exciting when it's someone who has such a big platform, but every single person who gets in touch and says they found something in the book for them, it's a thrilling moment.
Yeah, well, I know that you like to get to be got in touch with by letter, but we'll come back to that because letters form an important part of the book in the way the story unfolds in front of us. But possibly more important is the whole idea of pottery. Our lead character here is I can't get his name in front of me now. Murtagh. Thank you. Yeah. That's it. Murtagh Moon is a potter himself. How important is that to the story that you want to tell, given that the final section of the book is called Kintsugi? You might remind us what that art form is.
Yes. So it's such an important metaphor for the whole book, this art form of kintsugi. It was actually one of the main inspirations that got me going on this whole story. And it's where Japanese artists repair broken ceramics with gold and silver filament so that the cracks actually make the objects more beautiful than they were before. And they call it the art of precious scars, which I think is a beautiful thing. And it really supports that idea that sometimes the cracks in life are how the light gets in.
Yeah, the Leonard
Cohen
statement.
I really love this idea. Exactly. Leonard said it best, like with so many things. And I actually considered for a while calling the book How the Light Gets in honour of Leonard. But I think it's a really powerful idea to consider. And when you look at these kintsugi pots, they're so beautiful. And it really enforces that idea that, you know, we should feel comfortable embracing our past and allowing ourselves to be vulnerable and knowing that great beauty and light comes from bringing things out into the open.
Yeah, well, you toyed with the idea of using Leonard Cohen, but instead you used Emily Dickinson. The Truth Must Dazzle Gradually is a line in a Dickinson poem, The Dazzling Truth. Why did you actually, that's not the name of the poem. The poem is Tell All the Truth, but Tell It Slant.
Tell It Slant, yeah.
why did you choose the Emily Dickinson poem for the title?
Why I chose it, really, it came to me almost like a bolt of the blue. One day I was on the Underground coming home from London and I'd been really, you know, antagonising about what to call the book. And I asked myself, what is this book actually about? And in a sentence, I thought, this is about truth. It's about our personal truth and how sometimes that doesn't always align with universally accepted truths or what our families or society might expect of us. But it can be take a long time for us to reach that place where we recognise, you know, the truth that's going to set us free or that's so important in our life. And as I was thinking about this, that line from the Emily Dickinson poem just came into my mind like a bolt out of the blue, where she says, the truth must dazzle gradually or every man be blind. And I thought that was an amazing thing about how eventually the truth that we need to understand about ourselves can creep up on us, but it has to be gentle because otherwise it can be too difficult sometimes to absorb. And so then I just ran with it that was the perfect title. It felt like an omen.
Yeah, and have you always been, or are you a big fan of Emily Dickinson's?
I mean, I only know Emily Dickinson's in the most famous poems, I have to be honest. You know, it was strange that one came back to me. I remembered it, studied it in school. But since then, I've been reading more and more of her work because I feel like there must be a connection there, you know, that we've both kind of hit upon this notion of truth and it being so central to our work. So, and I think it's just... It really just resonated with me that she had somehow managed to express in just a few words something that I had spent 90,000 words trying to capture.
She may have spent a long time distilling it down to a few words.
To be fair,
but it's very interesting advice. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. It's a good advice to a storyteller, is it?
Well, I think I'm sure we all know as Irish storytellers, we have to go all around the houses sometimes, you know, to get to the point. And, you know, it's I think it's there's something in our inherent storytelling tradition that, you know, we come at the story from the side, you know, or come at it through, you know, the back door. And then eventually the kind of point of what we're trying to get to is revealed. Mm. So I think it definitely resonates with our storytelling tradition.
Which gives us an interesting what was in your mind with what you chose to open with. Because essentially you opened it, and I read this in a review, and I thought that's kind of what I thought myself as I was reading. It opens almost like a thriller in that we get a very tragic event, a very dramatic event in the opening section of the novel, and then we wind back to find our way to that event, if you like. Was that the starting point, just this tragic event that you thought, that's happened, now I have to go and find out about these characters, or how did that work?
Well, how it worked, the very first chapter was the very first thing that I wrote in the book. So that was always there with me from the very beginning. And it's interesting because it centres a lot on Maeve, who's the mother of the Moon family. But actually, the story began for me with her husband, Murtagh, who you mentioned is the potter. Mm. And he, for me, was really inspired by the stoic Irish fathers of a certain generation that are so beloved and that were adored by their children, but sometimes remained a mystery to them, you know, that they didn't really have access to the interior world because they held their council. And what would happen if one of these stoic Irish daddies called his adult children home one day and revealed a secret about himself, you know, something that he had bottled up his entire life, but that would change their whole view of him and their understanding of who he was as a man outside of being their father, and the impact that would have on a family. And so that was what I was thinking about. And it was so strange then when I sat down to write that first chapter, it all became clear to me what would have happened in the past that would have led him to that moment of revelation. So for me, I actually went on the same journey as the reader goes on, that I had Murtagh now and his wife and his family living on this island on the west coast of Ireland, but I had to work out where they'd come from. And so even though the first chapter is, you know, melancholy and a tragic incident on Christmas Eve, you know, gosh, it's sometimes I'm sad thinking about it even happening, and I wrote it. But then we go back to the late 70s in Dublin, and Maeve and Murtagh are meeting for the first time. They're heavily immersed in the music scene, bumping into Horselips and the Boomtown Rats, and their whole lives are kind of stretching out before them, full of excitement and imagination and possibility. And then we travel with them from those early days through their moving to the island, they're getting married, to having their children, and how their lives changed on the island. And hopefully by the time we catch up with that same incident about halfway through the book, there's a new understanding about why it happened, and then we continue on from there onwards until present day.
So really the title of the book is how the story came to you. The truth dazzled you gradually. Gradually you unfolded the story as you started from that point in, we're in the year 2015, aren't we? In 2005 in the opening section, and then you wound back to 1978. So the truth kind of unfolded itself to you as you wrote.
It did. It's actually an amazing thing that happens. Every single time I sit down to write, I think it's not going to happen today. I have no idea what's going to happen next. And then somehow the story just sort of unravels. It's something I say to a lot of people now who maybe have an instinct that they want to write, but get frozen by the idea that they don't know what the story is or they're not sure how to plot it. And I think just create the opportunity for the writing to happen and you'll be amazed what will reveal itself to you.
Yeah. And I noticed you call him Murtagh. I've been calling him Marta in my reading, but there you go. That's just a difference of pronunciation. So Murtagh and Maeve, I can't go too far down their stories because it unfolds itself on the page as we go through it, which is clever, obviously clever on your part. But two things that I did want to ask you to speak a little bit about. First of all, going back to 1978 Dublin, I'm pretty sure you were nowhere near Dublin or anywhere, in fact, in 1978. How did you find out about that period in time and the Dublin and the kind of popular culture that you show to us on the page?
Well, I mean, I wasn't too much far behind coming, you know, I wasn't coming on too much later than that. But
I don't think in Dublin.
No, I definitely wasn't. No, I think I'm very much in love with all the kind of mythology around the Irish music scene around that time. You know, loved Horselips, loved all those bands. And I was just really interested in what a dynamic time it was. And there's something genuinely really remarkable about the fact that Ireland produced U2 and these other bands who went on to be the biggest bands in the world. And what that does to a culture, you know, that we all grow up thinking that's totally reasonable, the possible thing that you could do with your life. And I give so much kudos for that to like Dave Fanning, who as a teenager I grew up listening to every night and introduced me to all of that music and that whole world, and to Jim Lockhart and Ian Wilson, you know, as producers, and you know how they kind of create, like, we're so important to the creation of this incredible music industry. And when I started kind of placing the book in that time, I had kind of music consultancy with Pete Holliday, who, you know, from the Radiators from Space. And I had such great chats with Pete where I would say, okay, so this gig is happening in the Baggot Inn and I think this would happen. Could that have happened? Does that seem reasonable to you? And, you know, I could have written, I said to Pete, he has to write a book because I could have written like 10 chapters with all of the, you know, incredible happenings that were going on then. So it was a really joyful place to spend some time in a fictional way and especially to kind of lift things after the kind of, you know, sad opening. It was, you know, great to then dip in there.
You did work here in 2FM at one period in time. In fact, you worked with Larry Gogan. I would have thought Larry, now you probably, he was coming towards, unfortunately, the end of his days as you were working on this novel. Well, certainly as the novel was being completed. Did you get a chance to talk to him at all about some of the music elements within it?
Oh, I did. And I have to say, I mean, losing Larry was such a blow in January. I think that I counted as one of the greatest privileges of my lifetime that I got to work with Larry. And in my first book that you mentioned, The Lost Letters of William Wolfe, Larry has a big cameo where the character comes across him and Stephen Greenstein, they just have been a quiz. And, you know, he's outside the quiz with his broadcasting assistant who gives him the score and tells him the prizes, you know, and the golden hour in the just a minute quiz like we all know and loved. And that had been kind of my role with him. So I just wrote it in as a kind of a little homage to all the time that we spent together. And, you know, it was, you know, he's just been so supportive of me with the writing. And even when he had a little retirement party when he finished up in 2FM and he listed off all the team he worked with, like he congratulated me on the book. And, you know, he couldn't have given more love and support and appreciation to all of the people he worked with. I mean, gosh, he was just, you know, it was a total privilege to spend time with him.
So that's the music side of it. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was island life, because the Moons moved to Inishogue, which is quite like either Inishmore or Inishman or Inishair. It has the smell of all of them about it.
I'm glad you think so. Yes, no, it was heavily inspired by Inishair in particular, where I had the great joy of spending many summers at the Gaeltacht in Colossal Lochtí Nafa. And I think I chose not to set it on the actual island purely because
You want to go back
there? I
thought
I would just get really... yeah, I don't want people working out who were the moons, and they kept that quiet. No, I think I was just really worried about trying to recreate it exactly right, and that would become very debilitating for me sitting in London, you know, trying to unravel a narrative where I was worried about, oh, is that really a mile from the pier? Could they have gotten across the island in that time? And, you know, it just sort of gave me that kind of creative freedom to develop an island that was really inspired by all the magic and the beauty. And there's something really special about, about that island on Inishere. It just got inside me. It infected me. And I think I've been the idea for this book has been percolating since I was a teenager and I never knew.
So in some ways, the Coláiste de Éirí years were your research for this novel.
Absolutely. I mean, it was such a strange thing. Like, as soon as I thought I was going to set a book in Ireland, even though, you know, I grew up in Portlaoise and spent all my years in Dublin working, the place that I actually felt the most creatively inspired by, and that I thought I could really imagine spending all that time inside, you know, a world of, was on the Aran Islands in Inishere. And I mean, no matter where I've travelled all over the world, it's still the place that I want to go to the most and that I love the most. So I really hope that any of the islanders who might read the book, even though it's a fictional version of it, feel that I have done it justice.
Let me finish up with something that Maeve says at one point along the way. We don't even need to know what she's talking about here, but she says, inevitable decisions are best made fast. Now, you had worked in radio and you packed it all in and you had huge success with the first novel, The Lost Letters of Walter Wolf. And then now this novel, I hope, brings you exactly the same level of success. Was it an inevitable decision that you made very fast to move towards writing?
No, actually, I have to say, in that instance, it was something that was a long time coming. I think I had this idea that real writers were born and not made, and that if I was meant to be a writer, that it would have just kind of happened automatically, that I wouldn't have been able to resist it, that it would have been like a compulsion. And instead, I was actually really scared of it and managed to kind of hide from it for a very long time. And I think it was only in the end, when the fear of never trying to write a novel overcame the fear of not being able to do it, that I was able to kind of, you know, get my nerve up to give it a go and, you know, and try and produce something. But it took me a long time to get there.
Well, listen, congratulations on getting there, not once, but now twice. That's Helen Cullen speaking to me about her latest novel, which is called The Truth Must Dazzle Gradually. It's published by Michael Joseph, which is an imprint of Penguin Books. 12 minutes to 8 o'clock on Wednesday night's Arena. Due to open next month in the Dublin Fringe Festival, Transmission is a new play written by and starring Catriona Ní Mhuirchiú, actor and former continuity announcer with RTE. In Transmission, jobs matter, occupations matter, particularly those Catriona sees as near obsolete, including her own previous role of TV announcer and that of lighthouse keeper, the job her late granddad did in Howth. Transmission is a one-woman show billed as comic, poignant and a meditation on the passing of time, and indeed a meditation on obsolescence. Catriona Ní Mhuirchiú is with me in studio this evening. You've gone to your own life, really, for this story, Catriona. Is that a frightening place to go to?
It can be, but I suppose that is the well I've gone to. And thankfully, I started with my grandfather rather than myself. It might have been a more frightening place if I started with myself. I don't know if I'd be sitting here at all. But really, what happened or how it started at all was that I was looking for something online, as we all do, and we go down a rabbit hole. And actually, I found a piece of online footage of my grandfather, who was deceased by then. And it was just really quite strange to see him on my laptop when I hadn't been expecting him at all, and he was dead for over a decade at that point.
What was the nature of that footage? What exactly did you see? And did you hear? Was there audio as
part
of
it as well?
Yeah, there's
audio, and they speak to him, and it's the footage was the last day of the Bailey Lighthouse, which was the last lighthouse in Ireland to be automated. And so it's the lowering of the flag at the Bailey Lighthouse. And his first and last positions were in the Bailey. And so they had invited him along, although he was retired at that point, but they had invited him along to be part of the ceremony. And they interviewed him, for a little tiny little interview with him at the end, but it was really strange. He was exactly as I had remembered him, but I had forgotten loads of those little details, and it was just a jolt.
And it's the type of jolt that I can only imagine the nature of the emotion you have when you see that. Had you seen it before?
Did
you remember?
I'd never seen it. I had no idea there was moving footage of my grandfather at all. Not a mind, you know, stuff that was online. Everything we have are 2D photographs, you know.
Yeah.
Except for tapes. My mother recorded him or interviewed him in the months leading up to his death.
It's a wonderful thing when a family member does that, and it's a terrible regret when a family member doesn't do that.
I have those regrets. Yeah,
join a long line in which I put myself as well. So your mother's tapes, I guess, were a large part of
they
what
were
you
a
mined
large
for this
part.
As well then.
And I had, again, you know, the thing, like life moves on and you move on from these things. And I had kind of hazily forgotten them. But having seen the footage, I remembered that my mother had done this. And I approached her and we got them. They had been done on a Marantz recorder. So we had to kind of go up the technologies, do you know what I mean? To find a technology that I could listen to them on.
And we hear it because I know there within the script that I saw there are references to audio. Is the audio that we hear actually your grandfather?
That's actually my grandfather, yeah.
Again, so, I can only imagine what that's like to hear that on stage when
you're
performing.
Yeah, it'll be really, it's really strange. And sometimes it really hits you in the middle of rehearsal, you know, and, you know, Gina Moxley is directing it and Raymond Keane is also all involved in you know, that you're just doing the pragmatics that you wouldn't rehearse. Oh, maybe try there or that tone or shift gears or any. And then you're listening to the audio, you think, my God, that's my grandfather, actually. And sometimes it can be a bit,
And I guess when it comes to the performance point, though, it'll become something else. It'll become the technical.
Of course.
There's my cue and here I go. But what was your grandfather's, and in fact, your great-grandfather had been a lighthouse keeper as well, hadn't he? But what was your grandfather's attitude to this? I mentioned in the intro the idea of obsolescence. What was his feeling around the end of the lighthouse keeper? Do we get a sense of that?
We certainly do in the tapes. I think because he had started so young, he had kind of moved along the technologies. And so he had been taught how to use radio by the British Admiralty during World War II because he was up in Mew Lighthouse. Mm. And then you get to, there's a beautiful little bit where he talks about somebody on the Fastnet gave him his telephone number, which is like, my God, you can ring them now. Isn't that extraordinary? That you can ring the lighthouses, you know. So there's a beautiful journey of technology through it.
Had he a sense of being obsolete or being made
certainly,
obsolete?
And in fact, all of the men in that footage do. I mean, it's absolute. It's absolute that a service that has been given is now rendered unnecessary. Technology.
And you know, I suppose it's a bigger argument as to which is better.
That's another argument. But certainly the human response.
The human level, the emotional level for him and for his colleagues.
Is gone, just gone. Yeah. It's a kind of a gobsmacked disbelief, really.
All right. Well, then let's talk about where potential obsolescence started to come into your own life.
Yeah.
Let me bring you back a little bit. I'm not sure what year. But
yeah, we'll fuzz that a little bit.
This is
the nature of time. Is
RTE television from some time back?
Oh my gosh!
Fresh rubbish, dachy, clark and lanya. Agus sasulikum grev nalig vahagiv. Agus kemek shan sasa on divinyo.
Well, there we are, Katrina in the work. Clearly working
on it.
Yes.
Oh,
you've never lost it then, the continuity and answerability.
If you're ever stuck.
You were working over the Christmas period, clearly, on that one.
And that was a great thing to get. You were delighted to get the Christmas because you got the goonie, you sat on the leather chair, you had a Christmas tree, you know, and you were envisioned for loads of the links as well.
And the RTE announcement, or the RTE announcer, how big a deal was that? How big a job was that a deal when you got it?
It was huge. I mean, it really was. I mean, I think the kind of earlier equivalent of it would be to get, you know, you were an air hostess in Aer Lingus. Now, that's an earlier version of it. But certainly, like, you were certainly in the lineage of Kathleen Watkins. I mean, that was still, you know, and we talked about it. Like, you applied for jobs, like, with an envelope and a stamp and, you know, so all of those things. But it was a big deal and people recognised you. wherever you went, really.
So you're looking at that job. Do you feel there's an obsolescence coming towards that particular role now as well?
I think what's interesting about it is it, obviously there are still on-air links and all of those things. But when I was there, the transmission system was automated. So as I was there, the system was changing. And so there was no longer so many on-air links, as in vision links, that they could see you.
Yeah.
And that was slowly faded out. And then sometimes later in the evening, those announcements were then recorded and put into this automated system. So you were no longer there. And it was always live up to a particular point, and then it, like, the system could just record you and you could just, you know.
And I mean, the live event was particularly nerve-wracking because it was about hitting time. Exactly. There was no bit to add. They can fill that in with a bit of a
filler. No, not at all. You
have
to hit time exactly. Yeah.
So that was one of the big...
Yeah, and covering breakdowns, of course, you know. Yeah.
Suddenly.
Mm. Yeah, suddenly something. I mean, my overwhelming memory, one of them, is Charlie Bird waiting outside Doyle Aaron to see if Haughey had managed to avoid yet another night of the long knives. And we kept going, but the news, the white smoke hadn't come up from Doyle Aaron. And my God, I'd say I read every single paragraph of the RTE guide.
Yeah. That was from what you filled with. So that you're looking at that job in this particular play as well. And then you moved from announcing to acting. How did that move come about?
Yeah, indeed. Question I ask myself. I think I was always interested in acting, and I had done it. And, you know, it's one of those things. I had my mother had applied for my to RTE on my behalf, and it was fantastic. But I had always had half an eye on acting, and I just decided to take the plunge, really. Mm. It was not an enormously informed decision, it has to be said, but a decision was made and I decided to do that.
Well, I haven't replaced the live actor just yet.
Not yet, but yes.
Who knows what's to come?
I was talking to somebody recently who's an engineer, a computer engineer, and they suggested that anybody who works with their voice should in fact copyright their own voice.
Note to self. Let's
let's have
a listen to a clip from the play then, because this is about the nature of time, which I think is at the heart of what you're looking at within it.
Time is such a strange thing. So mercurial. We're not even sure it exists. Or if it does exist, how it exists. Are we in time? Or is time in us? Our internal clocks marking out an ancient rhythm. Cronus carefully synchronizing molecules, neurons, chemicals, hormones. A 24-hour rhythm pulsating within us, even in the biochemistry of a single cell. And yet, what is time? Can time pass if nothing changes? Can we stop time if we remain the same? Sometimes I think we can. But then I remember there is no one time. There are multitudes of time. Mobs, hordes of time. So if you wanted to stop time, which time would you stop?
And that's a clip from Transmission, Katrina Niewiarka's new one-woman show, with some lovely effects and things going on there as well. But I just want to finish up by asking you, you know, when I read this earlier on today, and I was thinking, runs at the Abbey Theatre Peacock Stage from the 7th to the 12th of September. I thought, will it be happening at all? You must have been so relieved, like the members of the RTE Concert Orchestra were when I was speaking earlier to McSeaver and Brona Cahill.
Gosh, listen, it was such a relief to get the green light, and that came really quite late. I mean, it looked positive, but even last night I was like, will we be going out to Sean Thung? Well, the play that would have been, if
this
you
is
had
what we would
seen
have been
it,
doing.
It would have been. Of course. Yeah. And a lot of people were very nervous.
Yeah.
And of course, the arts weren't mentioned at all, and it all seemed a little unclear. But thankfully, a lot of discussions have been made, and
clarity has come to the white smoke was put up in this particular case. No more filling of time. That's it, Katrina Niewiarka, and Katrina's one-woman show Transmission is at the Abbey Theatre, as I said, Peacock Stage, from the 7th through until the 12th of September. And thanks to today's announcements and clarifications, that at this point anyway is going ahead. You get further details on fringefest.com. That is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Pather Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1.